So as mentioned, I'm pinch hitting for Rabbi Gmar, and since his topic was going to be on Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, a new interpretation, so I figured I'd speak for a few moments on Kamsa and Bar Kamsa also. The first thing just to point out is an editorial comment. You know, the stories of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash are found in Gittin. The story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, and many of the other stories of the destruction are found in the same tractate of the Talmud that has all the laws, how a couple gets a divorce. And this, of course, is not by accident, because the exile of the Jewish people in many ways represents a divorce. It's not a permanent divorce. There's a return, but there is a gerushin, an exile of the Jewish people. That's why, conversely, the mitzvot about Eretz Yisrael, the importance of living in the land of Israel, are in Ketuvot. That talks about the marriage contract between a husband and a wife. So whoever walks, for Amor in the land of Israel is guaranteed a place in the world to come. All the beautiful gemarot of the beauty of the land of Israel are in Ketuvot, which parallels the relationship when you have a ksuva between a husband and a wife. And unfortunately, the talks on the Churban Beit HaMikdash are in Gittin. The one in the middle I alluded to in the morning, with Rabbi Akiva. So it's interesting, we read about Rabbi Akiva, one of the 10 martyrs who was killed. We mentioned how Rabbi Akiva is the eternal optimist of the Jewish people. In every story, just look for the point that Rabbi Akiva always sees a silver lining in no matter how dark the clouds are. So the famous story at the end of Makot, when the five rabbis are walking and there are foxes, as it predicts in Eicha, it says in Eicha, Shu'alim Hochim Bo, the place of the Kodesh HaKodesh, in the Holy of Holies, there are now foxes. So all the rabbis are crying and Rabbi Akiva is laughing. Because there's a whole discussion, the famous piece, the Rabbi Akiva says, "Why said him? Why are you laughing?" He said, "Why are you crying?" He said, "What do you mean, why are you crying? Are you crazy? Here, the place that was once the Holy of Holies, and now it's all desolate, and foxes are there. Of course we're going to cry." And he said, "Of course, that's why I'm laughing, because the deeper our destruction, the greater our redemption is going to be." That's more or less what he says. I'm paraphrasing that. We know for sure the redemption is going to happen because there's a destruction. So he saw the future. But it's interesting, that piece of the Talmud is at the end of Makot. And Masechet Makot deals with the punishment you give to a person. The Rambam says there are 207 of the 365 negative commandments that you would get the penalty of lashes in theory. And that penalty of lashes that the rabbis teach would exempt you from the penalty of karet, excision. Let's say if a person, the really important mitzvot, not eat chametz on Pesach, and the big heavy duty mitzvot, hapkaret, a mechala Shabbos, say a bol nida, so they get the iser of karet. There are 36 mitzvot of the Torah that carry that punishment, and if you get makot, if you get lashes, you're exempt from the karet. So that's why, for example, after the Spanish Inquisition, a generation or two later, there was a whole movement, the Jews in Israel, to reinstitute smicha, to reinstitute the rabbinic ordination. And we also read in the Aserah who gave us the 10 martyrs, was lost. The Romans, the smicha has to be from person to person. Without getting into all the details, there exists a theoretical possibility of a revival of that, even though we've lost our chain of transmission. And that was instituted, the historians will point out, in the 16th century, because the Muranos, who had secretly converted to Christianity, felt extremely guilty, because one is supposed to give up one's life rather than convert to Christianity. So they wanted to get lashes. And the only way they could get lashes is if you would have a court. And the only way to get a court is to reinstitute the notion of smich. That's just a historical aside. But the notion, makot, is the punishment we get, but it has a benefit in the future. And that's why that story of Rabbi Akiva seeing the destruction, saw the hope in the future, that story appears in Makot. So that's how the Talmud, the stories in the Talmud are not just, they're tired after a long day in the Beis Medrash. The stories are edited with great clarity and precision. So the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, I'll point out a few of the interesting points, which may be our new interpretations, I'm not sure. appears, of course, in Gittin, and it's interesting in the fifth parak. And the fourth and the fifth parak in Gittin, I don't have it in front of me now, but if I recall correctly, are talking on the issue of on Darche Shalom. It's talking about all the ordinances the rabbis made to increase peace. For example, the Kohen gets the first aliyah. The Kohen gets the first aliyah, so they don't have any fights in shul. Since they're less Kohanim than everybody else, so there's less room, there still is room for fighting, but not quite as much. So the rabbis go through a whole series of decrees that we do in order to promote Tikkun Olam. That's this, you have the notion on the Prusbul, for example, the Shemitah year in Hillel, all kinds of other laws on Tikkun Olam, the betterment of the world, and a parallel set of laws on Shalom, Darche Shalom, to bring about peace. And it's sort of in the middle of there that the story, the Gemara brings the exact opposite, the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, which epitomizes the lack of Darche Shalom and the lack of Tikkun Olam. It led to a Churban Olam. So that's why it's not just anywhere in Gittin. It's in Nun Hei Amud Beit. That's where the Gemara begins. So I assume most people know the story, but just a few interesting things. So whether the story took place or not is irrelevant. This story, of course, it's always taking place. There's no historical context to the story, and that's, of course, on purpose. What's the name of the person who throws the big party? Anybody know? Why don't you know? Because we don't know. He has an Ahu Gavra. There, once upon a time, there once was a man, Ahu Gavra. That is the Talmud's way of saying this is a current event story. There once was a person. It's irrelevant what his name was, because this is recurring story, because the entire Torah, the entire Talmud is current events. The Talmud says that every generation that doesn't see the rebuilding of the temple is if they had destroyed it, because obviously we are at fault. If we would have been alive in the year 70, we're doing the same things, there wouldn't be a temple. So it's not the temple was lost in the year 70. We are losing it now. It's very hard to feel that. It's very hard for us to feel that. But that's what the Talmud means. That's what we're supposed to feel. We don't care. Who cares about what happened in the year 70? It's not that important. A historian will hopefully tell you this. The purpose of studying history is not to know the past. It's we can learn from the past. There's no facts are irrelevant unless the facts are applied moving you know forward. So in the Talmud, the story is Ahu Gavra. Now, it's very interesting. They're having a big party, a wedding, whatever they're having. Presumably, this is going on while, you know, Yerushalayim is burning. The Romans are making a siege. The whole story is taking place because, as the Rav noted, other people noted, through Yirmiyahu, the Jews did not believe in that the impending the destruction of the temple would actually happen. They were overconfident, as Rabbi Liebtag mentioned a number of times over the weekend, and they did not believe that this would happen. They're parting away. Now, Ahu Gavra, I'll read some of it inside. It's interesting, the Talmud begins the story, Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid. Blessed is the person who is always fearful, Mefachei Tamid, Umakshe Libo, one who hardens his heart, Yipo Bara'a, he'll fall in evil. So it's just interesting, when Dr. Basser gave the whole historical background on Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. And so I was thinking of that when she was talking, and the notion of pachad. The story she did not say, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was dying, so there's a famous story, the Gemara in Brachot tells us that his students came to visit him. And he was very nervous. And his students asked him, to say something on his deathbed, to give them a bracha. And he said, you should fear God as much as you fear man. The greatest rabbi of his time, saying what a kindergarten child knows. But you should fear God as much as you should fear man. So his students wanted something more. That's, come on, rabbi, give us something more. So the rabbi said, halavai, if only we would fear God as much as we fear man. We all know, what does a person do if he wants to do something wrong? He looks around, is anybody watching? Obviously, we fear man more than we fear God. And then the Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, that he's very nervous. He's going to die. He says, if I was going to face a human king who's here today and gone tomorrow, and I can bribe and corrupt, I'd still be nervous. It's still a nerve-wracking affair. How much more so? I'm meeting the King of Kings who is eternal and can't be bribed and knows the truth and knows my inner thoughts. Of course I'm very nervous. And he was very nervous about what's he going to say. Rav Soloveitchik beautifully explains, the Gemara has a lot of stories about rabbis on their deathbed. None of the other rabbis are nervous. They all are content with their life. They say, this is the merit I had. I came to shul early. I did this, that. Every rabbi had a different quality they wanted to pass on to their, you know, those who were coming after them. Why was Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai afraid? So the Rav explained, because Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had the future of Jewish history in his hands. He did not ask, as we heard, for Yerushalayim. He asked for Yavne. And maybe we know in retrospect it was a great move, but he didn't know that. How was he supposed to know that is the right move? And he was haunted his entire life that maybe he made a fatal decision for the Jewish people, and he blew it. And Ashrei Adam Efachei Tamid, I'm thinking, you know, the Pasuk, the Gemara quotes that Pasuk to introduce the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. I think it has application to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. He was nervous. And great leaders have to make hard decisions. They can't escape them. But it's a very nerve-wracking process, and we never know. It can take thousands of years before we know if they make the right move. Anyways, it says in the Talmud, a person should not be too haughty, arrogance. And then they quote the famous story. Hahu Gavra, there was a person, Derachme, his friend was, you know, Kamsa. Bar Kamsa, and the person he didn't like was, you know, Bar Kamsa. Now, what's the relationship between, you know, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa? Yeah, we'll get there in a second. Notice the Talmud does not say that Kamsa and Bar Kamsa don't get along. The Talmud says that the man making the party, he liked Kamsa, he didn't like, you know, Bar Kamsa. Maybe Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are best friends. Talmud doesn't tell. In other words, I think that people often think a Kamsa Bar Kamsa Charuv Yerushalayim, that because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, that Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are fighting. As we'll see in the story, one of the problems in the story is who is totally absent in the story. Who does not appear in the story at all? Kamsa. Kamsa, except he's mentioned. He's mentioned that the guy throwing the party had a friend. He doesn't go to the party because the mistaken invitation. He never gets the invitation. He never goes. We never hear from him. And yet, the Talmud blames him. Akamso bar kamso chavar of Yerushalayim. So that's one problem we have to deal with. Dr. Gundin pointed out that kamsa ubar kamsa sounds like a father and a son. Kamsa bar kamsa yamod, kamsa bar kamsa. I'm sorry? Yeah, now, what, right? Now, and also kamsa, of course, means what? What does the word mean? Likmutz, in a korban mincha, when you bring a meal offering, a flour, so the kohen has to bring a kometz. He has to grab a fistful of the flour and put it on the altar. That's a kometz. The notion of grabbing. It's also not these names. I doubt very much his name was actually, you know, Kamsa, but symbolically, this is a paradigm. This story. So Hahu Gavra, everybody. This story happens in every generation. He likes this one, he doesn't like then we'll have to get back to Kamsa and what the relationship between like Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Everybody knows he tells his servant to give the invitation, and he gives the invitation to the wrong person. Now who's totally blameless in the story in the eyes of the Talmud? Who's totally blameless in the eyes of the Talmud? There are lots of people who get blame in this story. As the story moves on, in every stage, they add another, you know, like they have the signs in the office. You know, anybody could have done it and nobody did it. Like, there are 85 people who could have ensured it wouldn't happen. All it took was one person to do something different, but nobody did anything different. So in the story, almost everybody who's mentioned gets blamed. Kamsa, Bar Kamsa, the rabbis, everybody's going to get blamed. The guy throwing the party. Who's the one person who doesn't get blamed? The messenger. The one whose fault it really is, right? Right? It's all his fault. If the messenger knew how to send a letter, a shlamazel, you know, so he can't properly deliver. He hit the wrong button on the email, you know. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's the guy who said that he's not blamed at all. I mean, I think the answer is obvious, but why is he not blamed? The rabbis are not giving you, this is not, you know, cause and effect. They're assessing moral blame. They're not assessing historical blame. Yeah, if the messenger wouldn't have made a mistake, this story wouldn't have happened this week, but you know, next week there would have been another story. It's irrelevant. The issues have nothing to do with this particular story. The fact that he made an innocent error, that's, we don't hold blame. Everybody makes a mistake. That's okay. The Talmud is giving us a moral story. So morally, the messenger did absolutely nothing wrong, even though his historically, so to speak, it's all his fault. So he makes the, everybody knows, he invites Bar Kamsa. Now, Bar Kamsa comes like to the party. How come? He should come to the party. He shouldn't come to the party. His enemy's making a party, right? That's how the story is. There is this guy. He likes Kamsa. He doesn't like Bar Kamsa. Now, it's presumably a father and a son, which makes the story even very interesting. He likes the son. No, he likes the father. And he doesn't like the son. That happens a lot. He's in business with the father, whatever it is. These are obviously, it's a very wealthy party. It's clear these are wealthy people here. And he has a servant, etc. So the father, somebody, he doesn't like the son. What's the relationship between Kamsa and Bar Kamsa we have to talk about? And why Kamsa gets blamed? So everybody knows what happens. He say he walks there and the... So why is he going? Maybe he thinks he's making up with him. I don't know. It's unclear. It's very interesting. If you were to get an invitation from a guy who you hate, what would you do? I'm sorry? Right. So that's the... Right. I agree. You could say he's making shalom bayit. Correct. That's what I would assume, and that could very well be. Perhaps, though, we just to throw in another wrench, it says, for example, we know in Hilchot Shuvah, there are times, let's say, in the laws of Lashon Hara. So, you know, if you wrong the person, you've stole money, so you have to give back the money and say, I'm sorry, etc. Let's say I libeled somebody. So interesting, the person does, he's not aware. He's not aware you spoke behind his back. So there's a discussion. It could be that halakhically you're not supposed to tell him because he'll just open up a can of worms. In other words, there are times you sinned against somebody, but if he doesn't know, why just leave well enough alone? So I'm not saying that is what he should have done, but you could interpret that before he goes to the party, he should check out what's going on here. There's something a little bit strange because if I want to make up with my enemy, I don't think the first thing I'm going to do is invite him to a party, to a wedding. I'm gonna call him up on the phone or send a message to have a private meeting or have a mediator. He's inviting him to a public, you know, gathering. Anyways, that's just as a, you know, your food for thought, you know, pardon the pun or whatever. Okay. So he comes there and he says, the host says, you know, Michte hu gavra bal debavahu, you know, I hate your guts. That's more or less what he says. So, he says, my bad hacha, what are you doing here? Kumpuk. Kum, get up and get out of here. I mean, it's what he says. Amar lei, so Bar Kamsa says, ho vatai, since I'm here already, it's embarrassing, I'll pay for my meal. So he says, no. So guy says, okay, I'll pay for half the meal. I'll pay for half the people, half the wedding I'll pay for. Guy must really hate him. He says, no, Amar lei, no. And we know this, that when people hate each other, money is totally irrelevant. The principle of the matter that they have. So then the Gemara says, Amar Leilo, Amar Le Yavina Lach Tmei Kula Sudach, I'll pay for the entire wedding. $100,000. I'll pay for everything. Amar Leilo, he said, no, I won't pay. Unbelievable. Either he's extremely wealthy or he really hates the guy, or both, you know most likely. Amar Leilo, Nakde Biyade, he lifted him up. The first time he said, stand up and get out of here. That's what it goes right. The second time, nakte biyate, he grabbed him by the arm and he didn't get a bouncer to throw him out. He physically threw him out. Now, everybody knows, what does Bar Kamsa do? So Bar Kamsa says, ho avahava yate rabbanan, who was at this party? All the leading rabbis of the day. This is a big philanthropist, I'm sure his name was on many of the yeshivot, and probably in the Beit HaMikdash, he donated money, you know. All the rabbis are sitting at the party. What did the rabbis do? Nothing. They didn't lift a finger. So Bar Kamsa says that it must be the rabbis agree with this, Bar Kamsa. Now, why did the rabbis act like this? I mean, it's sort of like a silly question, but just think, hold on. The the rabbis are sitting there, right? They see this like terrible thing in everybody's view. There's a big fight. The guy offers to pay for the entire wedding, not to be embarrassed. The guy physically throws him out, and the rabbis sit there and say nothing. How come? Money. So you read the story, and you read, and the story happens in every generation. Unfortunately, and as now the story begins, the blame of the whole story begins to focus on the rabbis. From here on in, the Talmudic moral, you know, Kamsa, Bar Kamsa, what do I expect? I can't expect much from these guys. But from the rabbis, I expect a lot more. So the rabbis said nothing. Unfortunately, they were caught up. It's a terrible thing, but we know how true it is that often, you know, people who could be a lot greater are afraid to speak out because of the fear. It's a very, very common problem. So he throws him out. We don't have time. We won't go through the whole story, which we know. So Bar Kamsa then says to the Roman emperor, the Romans, the Jews are rebelling. How do you know? So he says, why don't you send a sacrifice? So as we know, he puts a slit. The Gemara has a debate. The commentaries talk about it. He puts a slit either on its eyebrow or on its lip. That, according to Jewish law, invalidates the sacrifice, but according to Roman law, it does not. So they come, and he knows this. He's very shrewd. So the sacrifice comes to the temple, and the rabbis are having a discussion. What should they do? Should they offer the sacrifice or not? So what would you do? Anybody? Are you supposed to offer such, halachically, I mean, are you supposed to offer such a sacrifice on the temple? Why not? Because that has a mum. Okay, and why yes? Pikuach nefesh. One's life is in danger. Right? So which one wins? Who wins? The pikuach nefesh or the mum on the Beit HaMikdash? Mum on the right? Is it one of the big three? Right? So unless they thought it isn't pikuach nefesh. Right? So it appears pretty obvious that they have to sacrifice it. So guess what? So what did the rabbi say? What did the rabbi say? We're going to sacrifice it. The rabbis, they know halakha very well, the rabbis. The rabbi said, we're going to sacrifice it. Obviously we have to sacrifice it. How can we not sacrifice the korban of the Romans? We know in Vayikra begins, Adam ki akriv mikem. As Rashi points out, it, the notion of a korban is Adam. It's a human need, let's say, a human endeavor. And we accept korbanot from all people. We say, Yom Kippur, Vavayotim, Al Harkot, Shivisi, Machdivi, Beit Vilati. What do we say? Ki Beiti, Beiti, La Yikarei, L'chol Hamim. The Beit HaMikdash is not a Jewish abode only. That also has implications how we understand what's going on. It's universal applications. Beiti, Beiti, La Yikarei, L'chol Hamim. So the rabbi said, we're going to sacrifice it. So what happened? So why did they go and sacrifice it? Who remembers the story? No. Why not? One rabbi. Who is this rabbi? Rav Zecharia ben Avkulas. Anybody ever hear of him? Anybody ever hear of him anywhere else in the Talmud? Okay. Rav Zecharia ben Avkulas. One rabbi says, no way, we're sacrificing it. Reform. We can't do this. We can't do this. Now, 9,000 rabbis say we're going to sacrifice it, and one rabbi says we're not. Who wins? One rabbi. How come? Because usually when there's an extremist, the moderates are afraid. Right? That's right. The fact that there may be 500 million moderate Muslims in the world is not relevant. They don't speak up. Or Jews. It's irrelevant what a moderate says if they don't do anything about it. If the extremists carry the day, I don't care if 99.9% of the people are moderates. Totally irrelevant. Every rabbi said to sacrifice. One rabbi, not a well-known rabbi. Rav Zecharia ben Avkulas, not one of the famous rabbis in the Talmud. We have to be from, you know, he says, you're not from. But listen to what it says in the Talmud. What does Zecharia ben Avkulas say? Yomru, Bale moving, craving like Abayamis Beach. People will say, if we allow the sacrifice, people will say that you're allowed to bring an animal with a blemish on the altar. Rav Skari ben Avkulis knew your. He didn't care what the law was. He was concerned, what are people going to say? In other words, Rav Skari ben Avkulis himself said, we should do it. But if we do it, people won't understand. They don't know us from the Romans. They're going to come to the temple one day and they're going to see an animal with a blemish on its lip. And they're going to say, So explain to people. No. So because of one rabbi who was afraid of the public image of not frumkeit, they aren't, you know, he's going to say they're not going to go and be makriv the korban. So what do the rabbis do? So the rabbis, there are 8,000 rabbis, or how many are there? 119 rabbis. Okay, 120 people in the Anshei Knesset Hagdola. 119 rabbis, or 69, however you want to do it, a Sanhedrin. And one rabbi says no. So what? Why did they listen to him? I just said why they listened to him. But I don't know why they listened to him. I mean, that the fear. But so what did the rabbis want to do? They said, we have to kill him. Because they understood what Bar Kamsa was doing. They understood the whole thing. They're not stupid. They knew he's going to go back to the Romans. So we have to kill him. How come? How come they can kill him? It's a fascinating thing. The rabbis are willing to kill somebody, but they're not willing to put the animal on the altar. In other words, they could have solved the problem by ignoring what he said and put the animal on the altar, but they were afraid of him. But the story, it's mind-boggling. Like, I think, unless anybody has another explanation, if you think about it, the rabbi said, let's bring the sacrifice. Rav Skari ben Avkulis said, nothing doing. We can't do it. People are going to talk. So, okay, we're afraid. We don't want people talking. It's interesting. Here they're afraid they're going to talk. Right, the rabbis before at the party, they wouldn't talk. They weren't afraid what they're going to talk. I mean, they say, okay, they listen. But now we got a problem on our hand. What are the Romans do? Oh, we might as well kill him. Now we have to kill him. It's like, it's wild. So they're going to kill him. And do they kill him? Why not? Rav Skari ben Avkulis again. What's his excuse, you know, this time? Why don't we kill Bar Kamsa? Is it wrong? Is it wrong to kill Bar Kamsa? Who thinks you're allowed to kill Bar Kamsa? Raise your hands now. Who thinks you can't? Who doesn't think? Okay. All right. So, Bar Kamsa, the rabbis say we should kill him. So, you know what? Zakari ben Akula says, you're right. We're supposed to kill him. He's a rodef. But you know what will happen if we kill him? They'll say, people will say, where is it? Yeah. They'll say, Yomru, it's not, okay. People will say that if you bring a blemished sacrifice to the temple, you get a death penalty. That's what they said. Rav Skari ben Avkulis says, if you kill Bar Kamsa, no one will say you went and you killed him. That won't bother anybody. To kill somebody, that's okay. But God forbid we should bring a blemished, you know, like sacrifice. You get a death penalty for bringing a blemished, you know, sacrifice. So Rav Skari ben Avkulis said, you can kill him. In theory, but we can't kill him because if we kill him, what are people going to say? That if you bring a blemish to the temple, you get killed. No one will know that he's an enemy of the Jews. They won't know the whole story. You know, all the editors in the newspaper, they won't know. So that's, then the Gemara has one more line and the story's over. So the Gemara, Amar Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan lives in the third generation, I believe, of Amoraim. So this is a couple hundred years later. Rav Yochanan is commenting on the story. The story happened in the sort of pre-Tanaitic, at the beginning of the Tanaitic, you know, period. Rav Yochanan's an Amora, living a couple hundred years later. Anvunatato shel Rav Skari ben Avkulis hechriva et batenu v'sarfat hechalenu v'higlitanu mirtzenu. The humility, the anibus of Rav Skari ben Avkulis destroyed our house, burned our hechal, our courtyard, and exiled us from our land. That's the end of the story. So the story began with the blame on Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. You have the rabbis in the middle who are passive, afraid to get involved. They're passive the whole way. We're not going to put the korban on. They don't want to fight. They don't want to start up with anybody. They're just all very quiet. And then you have Rav Yochanan not blaming the rabbis so much, but Rav Skari ben Avkulis. And how does he blame him? Because he's very humble. What is being humble is normally a good thing, right? You know, Moshe Rabbeinu was very humble. So why, what does it mean? Because he was humble, we lost our temple. What does being humble have to do with anything? He wouldn't take a stand. Excellent. I'm glad you're here. Okay. So the Maritzchites in the back of the Gemara, he lived 150 years ago, but it explains beautifully that rabbis, you have to know when to be humble. Being humble has its place. But when you're a leader, you can't be. When there's a fateful decision to make, you can't be humble. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wasn't humble. He decided to give up on Yerushalayim, right? He gave away Yerushalayim in a peace negotiation, right? Not the first time. Wouldn't it be, it's happened historically. Jewish leaders have negotiated away the city of Yerushalayim. It's okay. We can live without Yerushalayim. We can't live without peace among us, but we can live without Yerushalayim. So he wasn't humble. A great leader has to say, take a stand. Who is Rav Schar ben of Kulis? I already pointed out, he's not famous. He's not one of the famous rabbis in Talmud. Rav Schar says, who am I? Who am I to make a decision? We're going to kill somebody. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, right, anachronistically, you look in the Shulchan Aruch, and it says a animal that has a mum on it can't be bought to make me. I'm going to say our times are different. I can't make such a decision. Only the gedolim of the generation can make such a decision. That's how the Maritzchites. He was unwilling to take the rabbinic mantle of leadership in a moment of crisis in Jewish history. So he took the easy path out. We can't be makrivit, that's the halacha. We can't do this. He didn't see the big picture. He was an anav. He was a nevus. And that's a nevus led to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. That's the story. I think it's a well-known story. Perhaps, hopefully, we offered a couple of insights. I just wanted to conclude and wrap it up. I asked at the beginning, what does Kamsa have to do with anything? What did Kamsa do wrong? He's totally non-existent, as we mentioned in the story. Judy? What did Kamsa do wrong? Ah, excellent. That's, I think, the answer. That's the point. The whole point of the story is inaction, right? The rabbis wouldn't speak. Rav Schar ben Kulis, no one would do anything. Passivity. That's exactly the sin of Kamsa. Kamsa knows this guy is his enemy, right? He knows he likes him. I know my best friend, he dislikes my son. Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, right? I know this guy. So if you're normal, what do you do? You call up, how can you be friends with somebody who dislikes your son? You're not normal. I'm sorry. You have to stand up for the honor. If somebody insults your parents or your children, you have to stand up for the honor of your family. So Kamsa, I'm not getting involved. They had a fight in business. Why should I ruin my business dealings with this guy? They're doing all very well. He doesn't like my son. That's not my problem. That's his problem. I get along with him. So he was totally passive. That's the whole point of the story. So the story begins, Kamsa bar Kamsa char Yerushalayim. Yeah, Kamsa didn't go to the party. He didn't even know about the party, for all I know. But it's not relevant. The fact that Kamsa did nothing, that's the notion of, that's what led to the destruction of the nation. So whether it's Kamsa or the rabbis, Rav Schar ben of Kulis, all the names, Ahu Gavra, it's all the same. It really doesn't matter. It's any generation. The message, of course, is that we have to act. We have to act whenever we see people who don't get along, even if they're not getting along, even if it's not us who they're not getting along with, but it's other people, we have to intervene. That's the real story. I think the real message of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa is not just that people didn't like each other, sinat chinam. That's not what the Talmud is talking about. The Talmud is talking about the lack of involvement of other people who could have intervened at so many stages in the story. At 10 different points in the story, people could have intervened and nobody did. And perhaps, I don't know if this is to end by the way we began, the story appears in Gittin, and that's it. What happens, unfortunately, in a broken marriage. Well, I'm not the marriage counselor, but the notion of you have to intervene. And, usually the problems in the marriage usually begin, they're not so severe. But if nobody does anything, if everybody is passive, whether it's the couple or other people who might know about it, who are close to the couple, they hope it'll go away. And that's not what happened. It grows. Like little problems, a little mistake of a messenger grows into the destruction of the temple. So that's true in Gittin, it's true in everything. So I think there's Kamsa and Bar Kamsa when we want to grab too much for ourselves, when we're only concerned about ourselves. The Yerushalmi says the Talmud was destroyed not because of Sinat Chinam. The Yerushalmi says because Ahavat Mamon. People loved money. And then the Talmud adds the love of money led to Sinat Chinam. They loved money so much, you can imagine when people love money, it leads to Sinat Chinam. So that's how the Talmud begins. that we should try to learn from Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, whether we are invited, we aren't invited. Everybody has a role to play, whether we're there. And hopefully the story can be sort of some relegated into the past. But this is, as we all know, I think as we all learned in, you know, since one is a child, Kamsa and Bar Kamsa are the epitome of why we're here on Tisha B'Av. And when we can correct that error, then we can turn, as Rabbi Lichtak said at the end of Shir, the Yom HaTzom to a Yom of Sason and Simcha. Okay, thank you.